Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. I'm always looking to help the Next Level Soul audience take their soul to the next level. And I've been able to partner with Mind Valley to present you guys with a ton of free masterclasses between 60 and 90 minutes covering mind, body, soul, relationships, and conscious entrepreneurship. Some of these masterclasses are taught by spiritual masters, relationship experts, best-selling authors, legends in the personal growth and spirituality space, and so much more. So if you want to sign up for any of our free mind, body, and soul masterclasses, just head over to nextlevelsoul.com/free. Now, today on the show, we have the award-winning author, Dawson Church. He's written amazing books like The Genie in Your Genes, Mind to Matter, and his brand new book, Bliss Brain. Now, Dawson and I had a fantastic and enlightening conversation about the science behind enlightenment. What actually happens to the brain as you start to transcend the levels of consciousness? He has been studying this for decades, and it is a fascinating conversation, to say the least. So let's dive in. I'd like to welcome to the show Dawson Church. How are you doing, Dawson?
Alex, great to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, sir. I am a big fan of yours. I've been reading your books for a while. I love The Blissful Brain, your book, and many of your other ones as well. Getting started, how did you start on this journey into a mixture of spirituality and science?
Yeah, it's a great mixture too, because like 100 years ago, 500 years ago, spirituality and science really going apart. And then, of course, with Darwin in the 1800s, they just had a big divorce. And so what's been so surprising and interesting in the last century is that they've been growing together. Things like the double slit experiment showing that the observer effect affects reality. They've been bringing the whole world of consciousness, spirituality, subject experience, and science together. And so I've been intrigued by science. And I also love the ability of science to explain things empirically. And when I began writing Bliss Brain, for example, I said to myself, what does the evidence show? What does science show us about meditation? And I asked all the basic questions, like how long a meditation do you need every day? How long does meditation take to start to change the brain? What are the most effective kinds of meditation? And these are all, if you ask a spiritual master, a spiritual tribe, a spiritual group, they'll have wildly different answers for you. And the Buddhists and the Hindus and various different sects and the Christians are all going to have their own answers. And then you view those questions through the lens of science, and then shows you, okay, empirically, this is how much time you need to meditate to really enter those states. The style of meditation is what evidence shows works best. Do it for this long, you have these effects. So I love science. I've just been, over the last 20 years, I've become more and more intrigued by the answer. Science gives these questions. I've written 3 best-selling books about it. And I just love seeing the world that way. And then applying that in my own life, Alex, and finding that as I apply the findings of science to my own meditation practice, that my life has just transformed beyond my wildest dreams. So that's been my motivation to share that with other people.
Now, how can we use meditation in the rewiring of your brain process? Because I've talked about this on the show multiple times, that we do get hardwired into our brains, certain things. It's kind of like a record, a groove, and you've got to kind of scratch it to this, you know, change it and actually rewiring it completely. But how can meditation help you do that?
Well, those findings are relatively new. And if you'd asked someone that question 10 years ago or 20 years ago, mm-hmm. it would have a totally different answer from what you get today. So what I was writing about in my earlier books 20 years ago was that evolution gave us this brain. This brain has what psychology calls the negativity bias, which means we pay attention to the bad stuff and we ignore the good stuff. Because obviously, back along the evolutionary pathway, if your ancestors were paying attention to how nice the roses smelled and were ignoring the tiger in the grass,
so much.
They got eaten. So our brains just were formed by evolution to pay attention to anything bad in our environment. Swami Muktananda was famous for one of his little exercises he did was he would take a white bed sheet and he'd grab a yellow, a red ballpoint pen. He put a dot in the middle of the bed sheet. He'd hold it up to his disciples and say, "What do you see?" And they'd say, "Swami, we see a red dot." And he'd say, "No, you're seeing a white sheet." You're just focusing on the red dot, tiny little insignificant part of it. And that's the way our brains are with danger. We can have a fabulous life, and yet we will obsess about the one thing that's wrong in it to the exclusion of everything else. And that's not because we're bad at positive thinking, because we're morally deficient. It's the way evolution trained our brains to operate so we wouldn't miss that tiger lurking in the grass. So that's the brain we have. And so 10, 20 years ago, our picture of our brain function was that our brains are wired for the bad stuff. In fact, our brains default to the bad stuff. Any little bit of spare capacity we have to have mental activity and have our brain active, it defaults to this network called the default mode network, which is obsessed with future threats, past things that almost gobbled us up alive, and building our sense of self. And so we default there when our brain has any spare capacity. And so that's where that was our best answer just a decade ago. Then research showed that we actually have other networks in the brain and we can activate those networks. So in Bliss Brain, I talk about this network very recently discovered called the Enlightenment Network. And the Enlightenment Network is what we see active in monks, in nuns, in long-term meditators. And what it does is it suppresses the activity of the default mode network and makes people so happy. Like I have an image in Bliss Brain of St. Francis of Assisi. And here he is, this famous Christian saint. It's called the Ecstasy of St. Francis. And you see him literally passed out in bliss. The guy is so stoned with on anandamide and oxytocin and serotonin and dopamine, all these bliss brain chemicals that we get in our brains when we meditate, that he's like literally passed out in ecstasy. And Rumi, read the poetry of Rumi from the Islamic Sufi tradition and some of the great Kabbalist masters and other great saints from different religions, and they are in these blissful states. So when we learn to turn on the Enlightenment Network, several good things happen. One of which is we dial down the activity of the default mode network and we pop into this state of ecstasy that is so far beyond. And this is a big challenge I have. I mean, this is like, I wish I could somehow convince people of this better, Alex, because I talk to other neuroscientists who study the same thing, and they tell me this, they have the same difficulty. We cannot explain to people adequately just how ecstatic those states are, just how good you feel. People feel so good in those states that they are literally in the same state as having had a slug of psilocybin, magic mushrooms, or cocaine or heroin. All the same brain drugs are in play in these ecstatic states, and you feel absolutely wonderful. So the new explanation now is that we have these states, they are so pleasurable, we're motivated to get more, just like after that slug of cocaine or heroin, you want more after that ecstasy of psilocybin, you want more. Psilocybin is just basically a plant-based form of serotonin that our own brains make, and heroin and cocaine stimulate the production of dopamine. And what we see in meditators is that their dopamine can rise by as much as 65%. They're having highly addictive experiences, and that changes the brain. The brain starts to change when you give it these powerful drugs endogenously from within, and then people start to shift their behavior, shift their traits, and all kinds of good things happen as a result of lighting up that Enlightenment Network, which in turn suppresses the default mode network and all the fear and misery and stress and anger and blah stuff we experience there.
It's so fascinating because I've been meditating heavily probably for about 7 years now, 6 or 7 years. And I've talked to multiple people on the show about this, that there's this bliss, this very addictive high, like you walk out, and it's not every time, because I'm, you know, I meditate 2 to 3 hours a day. So, but it's not every time I meditate, but I always get something. It's kind of like you could do cocaine, or you get a little high, but you still get high, but not like super high. Not that I've never done any drugs. So I wish I could have some sort of reference point. But from my point of view, there is that blissful moment where I walk out of my meditation literally high. Like I can't even it takes me about 5 or 10 minutes to come down from the high. And I'm almost bumping into walls sometimes.
Right.
It takes a minute to get down that way. And for people, I try to explain that to people. I'm like, it takes time to get there. You can't just start meditating and get there. But now this explains to me why I'm being pulled back into meditation more and more every day. Like my body, my mind is going, no, let's go back to doing that thing again. I like that. My question to you, what is going on in the mind when meditation is happening? Because obviously the drugs are being released, but they're doing it in a beneficial way where all these other physical benefit, your blood pressure, your everything calms down. And why is it that you're right, by the way, your stress starts to go down, your whole outlook on life starts to change. I always thought it was, you know, it is spiritual, but there's something else doing it. So from a neuroscientist point of view, what is happening?
What is happening is so interesting, Alex. And so you're finding you're there some days, you're fully there some days, you're partially there other days, but you're somewhere every day you meditate. Mm-hmm. And then you're also finding it that there's a transition period that you have to be aware of between hitting these ecstatic states and then coming back down. And you really need that transition period. I've forgotten to do that, or I haven't done that. And so you're not much good in the outside world when you're in that ecstatic state. And so what, you know, the traditional way of doing it, like even a few hundred years ago, a few thousand years ago, was that you didn't bother coming back. You went into the monastery, went into the convent, and basically you went there, you became a hermit, you were in the Himalayas, and you just went there, and then you never came back. Somebody brought you a bowl of rice every day and a cup of water, so your body didn't starve. But you basically, like, if you read about some of the great saints, like Ramana Maharshi, he became enlightened at the age of 16, went to this mountain, the sacred hill, Arunachala, and he went into samadhi, and basically for several decades, barely even spoke. He simply went there and never came back. So that was the model back then. And because, I mean, it's like, go back to the Middle Ages. I mean, you're in this ecstatic state. You really want to come back to this society where there's sewage running in the middle of the streets and there are people being slaughtered in intertribal warfare and people are starving off the time because the crop fails. And I mean, that wasn't a very attractive place to come back to. So that was the old model. But now we can go there. We no longer have all these external threats to our survival every day. And then it's important when you've been to that place, you need to come back because, well, a whole bunch of causes. Because you want to be functional. Like I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a grandfather. I want to be a great grandfather, a wonderful grandfather to my grandchildren. And I spend time with my grandchildren every week. I spend a lot of time with my wife and my family. And so I want to be effective at those relationships. I don't want to be a spaced out zombie, you know, which I mean, there's a lot of attraction to going there and never coming back, but you want to be effective in your family, you want to be effective at work. So what do you do? Like I have a big project called the Veteran Stress Solution, and started in 2007, and we give free treatment to veterans with PTSD, flashbacks, nightmares, intrusive thoughts. We treated over 20,000 veterans free of charge. And so that wouldn't have happened if I was spaced out on a mountaintop in the Himalayas. Those 20,000 veterans would probably not have been treated. So you want to do stuff that's valuable like that. And you need that. You need to move back into the world and be effective in the world. That's the global picture. And so social action, we need people who are voting, people who are doing social activism. We need people who are influencing public policy. We need people who are doing nonprofit work, who are volunteering, who are being great leaders. We need those people both out there and then with both feet on the ground when they come back here. And so if you listen to any of my, I have tons of free meditation tracks all over the web. People can just access those freely, listen to them, download them, use them. And I developed this form of meditation called eco-meditation in the like around 2008, because I just never had that good an experience in meditation. And this eco-meditation method is a combination of 7 science-based techniques like heart math and like biofeedback, neurofeedback, mindfulness, tapping, acupressure. It brings them all together in this very, very simple routine that's science-based, requires no belief, and then sends people out into the stratosphere pretty quickly, within about 5 minutes, usually, as we measure their activity, brain activity on MRIs.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
And so at the end of every one of those tracks, though, you will hear instructions like, feel your breath, ground yourself through your feet, feel the earth, open your eyes, look around you, count the number of light bulbs in the room, look for the biggest green object, find the letter V around you. So now we're orienting people back. We don't want them out there in outer space the whole time. We want them right here in their environment and to integrate this into their experience. So again, 1,000 years ago, you were the mystic in the Himalayas in your own space, going out there, never going back. Today, you're the wife, you're the father, you're the entrepreneur, you're the team member, you're the assembly line worker, you are whatever your chosen calling is. But you can have those ecstatic states and you come right back, and you come right back there every day and then ground yourself into the day.
Now, with the meditation, how is the rewiring process work with meditation? How can you use meditation to rewire the negative stuff or beliefs that you have, or, you know, the chatter, the negative chatter, the monkey brain, as we like to call it? Is it just a byproduct of meditating that it just automatically stuff starts to rewire itself naturally?
It does, but even enhance the process. And so in this brain, I looked at the research into how you accelerate that. And so meditation does, but the right kind of meditation is much more effective than the wrong kind of meditation. Like I tell the story in Bliss Brain of one of my team members, and he lived with his girlfriend, and he said, every day I wake up in the morning and she's meditating. She meditates for an hour or more every day. And I tiptoe around our apartment. I don't want to disturb her. She's meditating. And I don't want to interrupt her meditation. And so I'm very quiet when I move around in the morning. And this morning he told me, I just made a little sound and it disturbed her. And she opened her eyes. She screamed at me and said, don't fuck with my serenity. That's not meditation. I mean, that's what most people think meditation is. You close your eyes and then you try and go somewhere else. But she was so disturbed. She was so emotionally disturbed. That was her space. And so there almost huge chunks of what people think of as meditation are not only are they ineffective, they're actually counterproductive. You aren't getting anywhere. You're just wasting your time. So you want to do things that science shows you are effective. And there are a few things that really are effective. Being in your body, paying attention to your breath, being grounded in meditation through your breath is powerful. Feeling your heart, getting into heart coherence. Roland McCrady, who's the science director of the Heart Math Institute, told me in 2009, he said, Dawson, we've measured a lot of meditators, and when they meditate, they drop out of heart coherence. I thought, that can't be true. I mean, surely meditation is a calm stage to go into heart coherence. So after the conference, I talked to him, and I came back to where I lived. I had a friend of mine who was a longtime meditator, and I hooked him up to a heart rate coherence monitor. His name was Reverend Jeff. He was a wonderful minister, Unity minister, and hooked Reverend Jeff up to a heart rate coherence monitor. He had a beautiful, just serene pattern. Just with his eyes open, sitting there in the lab, and he said, okay, now Jeff, meditate. He closed his eyes, began to breathe, and he dropped right out of heart coherence. So Roland was right, and people actually are meditating, and they're not in heart coherence. So I designed Eco Meditation to put people there. So you need effective methods that get you into heart coherence, that get you into heart-brain synchrony, that balance the hemispheres of your brain. And so what we found with Eco Meditation, this very simple combination of various evidence-based methods, is that people go into synchrony between the left and right hemispheres, and they start to have a very little beta, which is, beta is the brainwave of thinking consciousness. They have a lot of alpha, they have quite a bit of theta and delta, these two slow brainwaves you're in when you're asleep. So they have a lot of these sleep brainwaves, but they aren't asleep and they are drowsy because they start to develop a ton of gamma, which is the wave of creativity, insight, joy, happiness, gratitude, and compassion. All the positive emotions are gamma. And the amounts of gamma they produce, like in one study, the researchers found that people were producing 7 times the amount of gamma as normal. And that number was so staggering, they just couldn't believe it. I mean, they expected to find maybe 50% more gamma. They found 700% more gamma. That's why I say it's hard to explain to people how happy you get. I mean, right. You're just so happy. You're in this gamma synchrony state of your brain, and it's powerful. That then stimulates the brain to rewire itself, because when the brain gets that hit of dopamine, hit of serotonin, these are reward neurotransmitters, and the brain wants more of them. That's why people become addicted to OxyContin and to heroin and cocaine, because the brain gets this hit, which stimulates the reward system, and it wants more of them. But in the brains of meditators, dopamine rises up to 65%. So you're now getting this huge slug of this pleasure and addiction neurochemical, and you definitely want to meditate tomorrow. So we generate that in the brain. People have more dopamine. And when your brain gets hit with that flood of dopamine, it pays attention and it starts to learn. What it wants to learn is, how do we, this tastes really good. How do we get more of this stuff? And so it pays attention to what you're doing. It then enhances the effect, and then people dial it up over time. So if you're consistent and you're entering that dopamine state, that reward state over and over and over again, day after day after day after day, now the brain is getting these pleasure signals and it's starting to rewire itself in powerful ways. One case history I have in this brain is a TV show host called Graham Phillips. And he heard about meditation, never had meditated before, said, I'm going to go on an 8-week mindfulness and meditation course. And so before he did that, he took his whole TV crew into an advanced neuroimaging lab, and they did a whole workup on his body, his reaction time, his psychological profile, and they measured minutely with high resolution MRI every single structure within his brain. He then began to meditate, be mindful, and within 2 weeks, his behavior began to change. In 4 weeks more, 6 weeks greater change. In 8 weeks, he went back into the lab. They measured the volume of tissue in each part of his brain, and the emotion regulation structure in the core of the brain. It's about the size of my little finger. It's pretty small, and it's right in the midline of the brain, and it has tentacles that reach out and regulate negative emotion. It regulates anger and regulates frustration and guilt and blame and resentment and all these negative emotions. That emotion regulation little structure, it grew in those 8 weeks by 22.8%. Wow. So now the brain isn't just doing a little bit of wiring here and there, the odd random neuron. That emotion regulation structure grew by 22.8% in 8 weeks. Now, it's not like every part of your brain is growing that fast, but key structures like your attention circuit, how do I pay attention? Your emotion regulation circuit, that grew 22.8%. in only 2 months. Your circuit for suppressing your worries about the past and your fears for the future, that circuit dials way, way, way down in meditating. So you want to use science and see what's effective. And then you will, within just 8 weeks, you'll literally feel your brain changing. One young man who's from Saudi Arabia walked up to me at a workshop I did in Paris, France in 2019. He said, I've been using your meditations for a few months now, and I feel my brain changing. And I said, where? And he pointed right over here to his forehead. And that's the part of the brain, the mid-prefrontal cortex, that handles that obsession with the past and future. He's coming to the present moment. He's learning to dial that down. And he literally feels the changes happening in his brain. So within 8 weeks, your brain is literally rewiring itself.
So you just pointed to the middle of between your eyes, which anybody who's ever studied any sort of Hindu or Eastern philosophy talks about the third eye. Is there a correlation between the third eye and what you just discussed about that place and that placement?
There is. Paramahansa Yogananda said the third eye region of the body and feeling sensations there is something to pay attention to. Sankirpal Singh, one of the great spiritual leaders of the early 20th century, said it's the link between soul and body. And so, yeah, spiritual teachers have been saying for a long time this third eye region is really important. And most people doing eco meditation after a month or two will report some kind of sensation in their third eye area. And then the cool thing too is that once you've done this for a few months, you start to have that tingling in the grocery store, at the mechanic shop, during work, at taking a walk at random times during the day. That mid-prefrontal cortex starts to activate. And so the benefit is that you don't just feel good during meditation, you start to feel much calmer outside of meditation. And it's that same, that's the brain area that's affected.
I'll tell you what, I mean, from where I was 5-6 years ago to where I am today, it's drastically different as far as anger, as far as worry, as far as stress. I look at things very differently than I used to. And I really, you know, just thought it was part of the process, but you're literally now breaking down the process. And now it's starting to make scientific sense why this is happening, because it is. And if you start studying spiritual teachers and spiritual masters, they all go through this process. They don't just get born enlightened. They need to work towards it. And it's a process. And so, you know, one day maybe you can break down the Buddha's enlightenment. Like, what was his process to get there scientifically, if there's a way to do that?
There actually is. And so there are two paths. One is the long path. And the long path is the way that we've known about for a long time. You join a monastery, you take vows, you spend a lot of time, the 10,000 hour rule, meditating, being under the guidance of a spiritual master. And then maybe after 10 years or so, you become an initiate. You go through another part of the journey as an initiate. Eventually you graduate, and the, you know, the spiritual traditions have a good track record of every, there's a percentage of people who go do the long path who do break through to the state called enlightenment. And enlightenment means that enlightenment brain network is active in a much greater degree. And the default mode network is relatively inactive. So inactive that in masters, people who already mastered this after many years of meditation, that key stress structures in their brains begin to shrivel. Like the amygdala begins to actually shrivel up. It's your main area of your limbic system, your midbrain, that sends the stress signal into your body. And you aren't doing it now for 6 months or a year or 2 years or 5 years. So the brain notices, hey, he's not using that part of this tissue. We don't need that there. So it begins to actually shrivel up. And so we find that in the brains of these adepts. So that was the long path. It works. There's a lot of value to discipline, to really observing things like dietary cleanliness and food and water cleanliness. All those things have a role, but it's a long path. And then there's what Ramana Maharshi and his many other people have called the short path. And the short path is when you do certain things to catalyze enlightenment. And so I've been working with several people for the last few years on putting those steps together, those catalytic steps, into a neuroscience-based course. We're taking the principles of Vedanta, this ancient tradition that's thousands of years old. We've been looking at which ones stand up to the test of neuroscience. Like some of the Vedanta stuff really put people in an MRI, nothing happens. But put people in an MRI and they do other Vedanta things, and there's really rapid shift in their brains and bodies. So we now put together a series of actually 36 milestones on the short path. And we're now bringing people through the short path process. We're measuring their degree of happiness, satisfaction, but we're also measuring their job productivity. We want to see, are they becoming better fathers and mothers and team members and better entrepreneurs? And are they able to translate those enlightened states into everyday life? So there's actually a curriculum we're putting, we haven't announced this yet, or we haven't offered this to the public yet. It's been an intensive development with several neuroscience colleagues, several mystics, but we'll be announcing it actually in June of this year. And we'll have this curriculum that takes you through these 36 milestones over the course of 9 months of the short path. So there's a long path that we've known about for a long time. There's a short path, and we're finding that people can get there in about 9 months of short path practices.
So are you saying that you can get into enlightenment in 9 months? We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's what we're finding. People are in persistent states. We call it persistent fundamental well-being. They cross a threshold where they are basically fear-driven and environmentally plugged in. They're worried about everything going on around them. And then they have a transition. And when that transition happens, they suddenly unplug from stress. And they have this immense bliss. Sigmund Freud called it oceanic bliss. And you're in this bliss state. And you click in and you don't come out. You just are in that bliss state after that. And so we're finding we can lead people into this deliberately using neuroscience-based techniques.
Wow. And you're working with mystics and spiritual masters as well during this process?
And neuroscientists, yeah.
That's fascinating, Dawson. That is absolutely fascinating. Well, I mean, sign me up. You let me know when it's available and I will sign up. Absolutely. No question. Now, there's another aspect of things you've talked about over the years called EF tapping. I've heard about it. I've never done any serious research into it. What is EF tapping? EFT tapping.
EFT, yeah. One of the pitfalls of the spiritual path is the dark side. And just to mention a few well-known examples, there's been a huge scandal in Shambhala Buddhism over the last 10 years with the head of the order being accused of some fairly substantial malpractices. So that's, you know, Buddhism. In Hinduism, same things happen, some of the things with some various gurus in the last 15, 20 years. Sure. In Christianity, we have numerous scandals, Liberty University, John of God. John of God, I mean, this guy who was revered for decades as a faith healer, John of God is his name, and now is in jail for 17 years for molesting his students. So there are all these scandals in Christianity and Buddhism and all the religions. And what happens is if you go to the mountaintop, I mean, were these guys in enlightened states? Most of them were, but they never went to see a therapist. They never took care of trauma. And they had psychological trauma from childhood. They've been traumatized growing up and as adults. And so it's wonderful to ascend to these elevated states, but you have to go there and heal psychological trauma. So I teach meditation to bring you to the mountaintop, but I teach EFT to resolve that trauma. And everyone in the meditative community and the spiritual path hears about the dark night of the soul. And the dark night of the soul is what you hit if you haven't healed trauma. And it often just takes people down. So you've got to go and heal trauma. And EFT is brilliantly effective at doing that. It uses acupressure rather than acupuncture, uses pressure on acupoints. And people think about bad stuff that's happened to them. They reflect on their past wounds and they just go deep into their psychological and spiritual wounding and triggering. And they're using these acupressure techniques and it releases all of the emotional components of that in a process called memory reconsolidation and extinction, where we literally have them reconsolidate the memories back into their neural network of the trauma, but we extinguish the emotion. So they remember the bad stuff. Like one young Vietnam veteran, one young Iraq veteran, he'd been in the Battle of Fallujah in 2004. He was incredibly traumatized, had PTSD symptoms, and he had just like horrible experiences. And I did EFT with him. He came right out of it to where he could remember those experiences, but he no longer was emotionally triggered by them. I checked back with him a few months later. He was still fine. So we've done that now with thousands of veterans. We have done 7 randomized controlled trials. They all show the same thing. People just have a lifelong release of that trauma. So it's great to do the meditation. You have to do the trauma work as well.
So what is, can you give an example of what this EFT tapping is? Like, for an example, I know I saw somebody tapping in the middle of the brain or the middle, the middle between the eyes. What exactly, like, explain it a little bit to me. Like, what can, like, physically, what do we do?
Yeah, so what we have people do is, first of all, remember. And research shows you have to remember the bad stuff of your past before you can effectively release it. And so we have people actually get deep into what mom did, what dad did, what brother did, what cousins did, and they're literally remembering the worst experiences of their lives. While they do those, while they recover those memories and recall those memories, they then stimulate a series of acupuncture points by tapping on them. And these are on all the meridians of the body. There are 14 meridians. They tap on each one. And it's amazing to watch people doing this. Like, they'll be just really sucked into a trauma. They'll be emotionally flooded. They'll be overwhelmed. They might be crying. And then they start tapping. And it's just like all that stress rolls way off them. Their energy system balances. When we have them in an EEG or watch them in an MRI, their brain function comes back to normal. So they go from being highly triggered emotionally to releasing all of that stress and trauma. When we measure their cortisol levels, they drop dramatically. In one study, in a week of tapping meditation, people's cortisol levels drop by 37%. And when the cortisol levels drop, all kinds of beneficial hormones actually kick in and rise. So big biochemical changes, big brain function changes, big physiological changes, their heart rate goes down, their blood pressure goes down, all the symptoms of stress reduce as they balance their meridians with the tapping.
So, but what's actually happening? Like, you know, just going like this, is it actually, what's the physical thing happening to the brain? Because I get the concept. But I'm just curious, like, when you hit that, is it kind of like the acupuncture, like it releases the energy, or is it just a rewiring process that happens when you're tapping?
We know that a lot of the acupoints are on points on the skin where there's really, really high conductance. And so we can use a tool called a galvanometer, run it across the skin. And whenever we hit a point that's highly conductive, in other words, it conducts electricity really well, that galvanometer lights up. And it turns out that it lights up exactly where 2,000-year-old Chinese scrolls show us acupuncture points are. Right. Now, you know, it's just like one of those crazy things. How do these people 2,000 years ago write these scrolls in China and show these acupuncture points? When we run now a scientific instrument over the skin, it starts beeping when we hit a point, because it's a point of very high conductance. Mm-hmm. So when you are tapping like that, you produce a form of electricity called piezoelectricity, same electricity as you use on a gas stove or a barbecue grill. When you go click, 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 and it lights. Mm-hmm. When you go tap, 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 it sends a piezoelectric signal, and it goes through your connective tissue, goes through your fascia, through your ligaments and tendons. And usually people feel a sense of malaise in their bodies when they're reporting a trauma. So they'll tell you about how my older brother almost drowned me when I was six, how the bully smashed my face against the curb when I was nine. They'll be telling you all these stories of abuse, and they'll be really emotionally triggered. When they tell you the same story and they tap, they start to lose all that emotional triggering and they become calm. And what we see in EEG studies is that their emotional brain goes from being all lit up. So initially they're telling the story, they're highly emotionally triggered. When they tap, they then discharge the energy and the brain calms down. And they'll also report a sense of physical triggering when they're describing an event. Like, I worked with one doctor, one physician, and he lost all his money in the 2007 financial crash. And I said, "Where do you feel in your body?" And he said, "It's like a black bowling ball in my stomach." So he's feeling this, and it's actually a physical feeling in his fascia or in his muscles. And when we tap, we find that those signals, electrical signals traveling through the fascia, they travel very, very, very quickly through the fascia, much faster than neural signaling. go travels, and then those physical feelings of malaise just lighten up. And I asked him later, you know, I asked him in a few minutes, where do you tune back into your gut? How do you feel? He said, well, the black bowling ball is now the size of a soft, white, fluffy tennis ball. And we kept on tapping. He said, now it's the size of a pinhead. And then it was gone. So his physical body is giving him different signals, and all the emotional information that his body's been holding around this. Wilhelm Reich, one of the great psychologists of the early 20th century, called it body armor. That body armor starts to soften, and then people's bodies release that feeling of trauma, and they then recall the event later on without the emotion.
So you've got to deal with this trauma before you start going down the path of trying to find these higher states of consciousness, because
permanently you can go to those higher states for a little while, and the Sufi school that the glimpse, it's fine to get a glimpse, but if you try and stay there without dealing with trauma, that's when you hit the dark night.
It seems everything we've spoken about, it is very, you can associate it with drugs and other things that you can, you know, you could be either alcohol, drugs, sex, anything else that creates that kind of high where people can get addicted to it. You could truly find it all within yourself. It's cheaper. less damage to your bank account and to the people around you.
Actually only
beneficial side effects.
Yes,
of going down this road. I've been preaching from the top of my mountain for a while of what meditation has been doing for me, but I've never really sat down and understood how it was used in the rewiring process. This is a fascinating conversation. You've spoken about something called the 9 gamut yes. procedure. What is that?
Yeah, that's one of the techniques used in EFT and EMDR. And so EMDR, essentially EFT and EMDR are very, very similar to each other. And so they both use tapping. And tapping, we found, has this calming effect, but they both also use eye movements. And when you are asleep, so we sleep for roughly 8 hours a day, and when we close our eyes and go to sleep, our brains drop out of beta, which is the brainwave of ordinary consciousness. It's 12 to 30 times a second our brains are firing. That's beta, that's the wakeful wave. We drop into alpha, and alpha is 8 to 13 firings a second of our neurons. So we're getting drowsy, we drop into alpha, we then drop into deep sleep, we go down through theta, which is 4 to 8 cycles a second, then into delta, which is 0 to 4 cycles per second. We spend about 90 minutes in delta when we're asleep. Then we have a period of wakefulness, and we dream, and we're in theta, 4 to 8 cycles per second, and our eyes move around really rapidly in theta, and we have vivid dreams. And those dreams actually are dreams in which our subconscious mind is trying to solve actual problems in our lives. So there's a whole branch of dream yoga. There's a whole branch of psychotherapy around dreaming, dream therapy. Gestalt therapy is a whole section on dreams and gestalt therapy. It's a highly significant way of the brain. The brain is rewiring like crazy in that theta state. So that's how we sleep. We're in theta for a few minutes. We drop back down into delta for an hour or more, and then we come back into theta. So we have about 5 of these theta dream phases during sleep, but our brain is solving our problems. What we do in the eye movements of EFT or EMDR is we mechanically move our eyes around. So we think about a problem, if we focus on something bad that happened, and then we move our eyes around deliberately, similar to the way we do in rapid eye movement sleep. And people have a real shift in their ability to handle problems, and they feel much better after the 9 gamut. And so we use it for things like prenatal trauma, because it's hard to treat prenatal trauma. It's hard to treat pre-verbal trauma. But if you were traumatized 0 to 2, those sorts of messages you were getting back then that weren't healthy are extremely hard to solve with conventional talk therapy. So we use the 9 gamut, we use eye movements, we use all kinds of nonverbal methods for nonverbal traumas. And also highly traumatized people. We've worked with volunteer teams, for example, have worked with children in Rwanda whose parents were killed there during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. We've worked in places like Newtown, Connecticut, and Parkland, Florida, where there were school shootings. We have volunteers now working in Ukraine during the Ukraine war. We've just made available, made our trauma training available free to people who are treating refugees in Ukraine and others in Ukraine. So there's a lot of evidence showing that these eye movements can really rapidly deal with deep traumatization like that, that otherwise is very difficult to treat.
Dustin, I have to ask you, you've now worked, you know, in this field for decades, and you've had the pleasure of not only living in the scientific world, but you've also, you know, have been working with spiritual masters and gurus and yogis and things like that, Buddhists and so on. How has that affected you spiritually? How have you, like, because you obviously have a scientific look at things, but with all of this on the other side of the fence with the spirituality, has that affected you spiritually?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, I think it has slowly. It certainly has not been, you know, like Ramana Maharshi, he 16 years old, he just realized he was going to die. So he said, okay, I'm going to lay down here. I'm going to pretend I'm a corpse laying on a pyre, and I'm going to die right now. And he spent about, the experience lasted maybe half an hour, and he got up and he was enlightened. That's the kind of experience we all wish we had. Eckhart Tolle sitting on a park bench and just bingo, Byron Katie in a halfway house, just a hopeless addict, and a cockroach crawled over her foot. She woke up, looked at it, and bingo, she was there. I'd love to have had that bingo experience.
All of us would.
For me, it's been a long, hard slog, and I just spent years and years and years doing this and got a little bit better. But things really shifted for me in 2000 when I made the decision. I was going to meditate every single day, no matter what. And so I began to meditate every single day that year. And that's when my money, my health, my career, everything began to shift. So that made the difference for me. And then I solved a lot of problems I struggled with before using psychotherapy. And so early I'd been using psychotherapy in the 90s, 80s, mostly Gestalt therapy, other kinds of therapy too, family constellations work, parts work. But I made slow progress. When I began to meditate every day and then used energy therapies, I changed radically quickly. And then I began to hit levels of happiness that just astonished me. And so I wanted to write about them and share them. And then I got to a point at a certain point, I had this lawsuit where somebody who'd been a mentor of mine sued me. And I just love this guy. I really, you know, respected him. He taught me a lot. And then he had some mental health issues and he sued me. And this lawsuit dragged on for 7 years. And it also drained tons of money, millions of dollars out of my business, out of my life. And I think about this guy and I just feel such compassion for him during that 7 years. Because I thought, wow, you know, to be suing somebody for so long and so be so persistent about trying to damage them, he must be suffering so much. And so I'd say this, and I'd say it to my wife, and she'd say, "Screw him! I wish he dropped dead." So she was not on the compassionate end of the cycle, but that really taught me a lot to have somebody who is really angry and really trying to injure me very directly and personally, and then just being compassionate for them. And now you get to that point where you are just in compassion. And so I've had a few, like, you know, ups and downs. You cross this threshold at a certain point that we call making the transition, where you're just completely at peace. And then stuff happens. Like I tell the story in Bliss Brain in chapter one about how my house burned down in a California wildfire. And it was absolutely shattering an event. I mean, my wife woke me up at 12:45 a.m. and shook me by the shoulder and said, "Something's wrong." I looked outside the window and there was this wildfire just racing toward the house. We just sprinted out as the trees above our head were catching a blaze and drove out of there at high speed and barely escaped. from a fire that consumed 5,000 homes and killed 22 people, right around, many of them right around us. And so we lost everything. We lost our home, we lost our office, we lost all our possessions except for our phones and that car. And we had a very difficult couple of years after that. And that was only the start of bad things happening. But other things happening that happened as well that in those 2 years, which I tell about in this brain. So we had these things happen. And yet as I'd meditate in the year after the fire, at that point, I'd also lost my retirement savings because of things to do with the fire in the business. So I was broke, no possessions, no money, no home, living in a borrowed apartment. And I meditate and I just write in my journal afterwards about how I felt so prosperous, so loved, so supported by the universe. I was in ecstasy. And I thought, I have just got to share this with people that you're out of circumstances, you can lose everything. And you can still be not just okay, you can just be ecstatically happy every day, giving thanks, dancing, and singing. My wife used to dance, and I used to dance around the borrowed apartment. We would put on some music after dinner. We would just start dancing, and we just had a wonderful time. We traveled, we did things, we saw friends. So I wanted to really share with people, your life does not have to be perfect on the outer level for you to feel absolutely blissful on the inner level. You can lose everything and still feel ecstatic. And that's really the message of Bliss Brain, is that you can move to these states of ecstasy and just get there. And so I didn't plan to leave. I plan to keep on teaching and doing my best to share this with people. I certainly do one time myself. I take 3 months off to go on a meditation retreat in the winter. I go to Hawaii for 3 months. In the summer, I may go away for a month or a week and just go into the forest and spend time with the all that is, because you want to give yourself that as well. So it's a balance between honoring that part of yourself that needs that nurturing and that time with just losing yourself in ecstasy, with being an effective person. I'm running my nonprofit and running my business. I want these things to be impactful and effective. And then I also want time to step back and just bliss out and be on the mountaintop, be in the cave in the Himalayas, metaphorically speaking, and just enjoy that experience too.
Dawson, you are an inspiration, my friend. I truly appreciate you coming on the show. I have a couple questions I ask all of my guests. What do you believe is your mission in this life?
When I was a teenager, I had an experience. I was stuck in despair and I was suicidal and I had all the symptoms of PTSD. And then one day I was sitting in my room, just wanting to kill myself. I just didn't want to be here. I just did not want to be here. And I hadn't wanted to be there for about 10 years at that point. And I suddenly had an experience of like drifting in the universe, drifting in light. And I literally felt as I was seeing the fabric of the cosmos, and it was love. And so I thought at that moment, that's my mission in life. I'm just going to share this love however I can. It's taken me a long time to work out the science of it and to have an effective message around it. But I think sharing love. And so I asked myself, how can I share love? If I see somebody who's suffering, I say, how can I share love with them intelligently and effectively? And so sharing that message that we are love, you know, Alex, we have these physical bodies. We have this 70 or 100 years on Earth. And yet we come from infinite consciousness and we return to infinite consciousness. And so the sooner, like Ramana Maharshi dying at 16, the sooner we let our human personality, you know, it's going to die when our bodies drop dead anyway. How about letting it die right now? All the saints, St. Francis used to live with a skull in the corner of his room to remind himself of mortality and just the you know, why cling to the self you think you are? It's pretty miserable. It's not having a good time. Drop that self and then simply become one with what you were before you were born, what you will be after your body dies, and then live your life as that. So letting people know that that's what we came here to do, and we have this hardware in our brain called the Enlightenment Network, which is hardwired. I mean, nobody does not have the Enlightenment Network. Every single person has that wiring in their brains. All you have to do is dial it up, which will dial down the default mode network, and you're going to hit states of ecstasy that you just can't otherwise imagine And then you're going to be effective in the outside world. So my mission is to share with people this is possible, to convince them. And most people are hard to convince because they're so used to dealing with their stress-filled life and their limitations. They think it's my body, it's my history, it's my education, it's my genetics, blah, blah, blah. All these excuses for not being our full glorious selves. And when you drop all those excuses and you just enter that state of communion and then realize you're that, and then you bring it into everyday life, your life is just an absolute marvelous gift every moment. And you don't need anything to do it. I wrote in my New Year's message to my community, I said, just notice your breath, your breathing. Just be grateful for your breath. Take a step, look at your feet. Be grateful you have feet. There are about 30 million people in the world with breath disorders and lung disorders who can't take that breath. Another 30 million who don't have feet. So you're taking a breath, you're having feet. Just start there with gratitude. And it's just going to fill you up with gratitude to just be alive. And then you get to do things, you get to hug people, hug children, look into the eyes of friends, touch the grass, see the sunset. Wow, what a life.
That's amazing.
So convincing people to go live that life and not stay stuck in those little limited boxes we think we have to live in.
It's like all the spiritual master says, everything I can do, you have the ability to do as well.
Yeah.
You know, so it's so funny that you're now connecting the spiritual with the science. Like, no, there's a thing in their brain. It's called the Enlightenment Network. We called it, and this is this. And then when you click this, and this is what happens. It's pretty fascinating. And what do you believe is the ultimate purpose of life?
Well, if you flip those two things around, so we have minds and bodies and emotions. So if you ask what is the ultimate purpose of your human life, I think the initial purpose of your human life is to understand and experience that you're more than that. And I think that you as life, you the infinite you as undying consciousness, that purpose of that you is to inhabit your body and your mind and your heart. And so there are these two halves of you, two parts of you. One is the local you. I call it the local mind, the local body, the local emotions, the local world. And so having the local world, just being in the local world, is powerful. And then the purpose of that local self is to discover the non-local self. And then the purpose of non-local self, the non-local you, the consciousness you, is to inhabit the local you effectively. And that's why I'm really saying that the time to go to the monastery and go to the mountaintop, that was back then. Today, we have global warming, we have climate change, we have war, we have species extinction, we have pressing problems. We don't need people up in the Himalayas meditating. That's been done. We need people who are effective at social action, political action. We need social entrepreneurs. We need people who are passionate about living their transformative message in their lives. So that means bringing all that consciousness down into effective action at the local level. So the purpose of life, again, in the local sense, is to hook up with non-local. The purpose of non-local is to be with local. And then that's the state that the masters call non-dualism. There's no us and them, there's no me and it, there's one. And then that all flows together. And that is what I believe is going to make a huge difference in society and in our world. We're going to solve all kinds of social problems, financial problems, income inequality problems, climate problems, species extinction problems with the wisdom. We don't get it from local wisdom. We get it from non-local wisdom. And we're going to be having us human beings collectively will have a huge impact on the well-being of the planet in the coming decades as we translate that purpose of all life into our local reality.
And Dawson, where can people find out more about your work and get your new book, Bliss Brain, and so on?
Alex, the best place is to go to blissbrain.com because you can get the book there for free. You pay shipping and handling, but you get the book free and you also get 8 meditations. And we've done MRI research on those meditations and they start to actually rewire this part of the brain and the compassion part within 4 weeks. We have a study coming out in a top tier journal later this year showing significant rewiring of the brain within a little while. So go to blissbrain.com to get the book and the meditations. We also have an immunity meditation at a different site, and that is one based on research we've done showing that as your cortisol drops using certain kinds of meditation, your immunity rises. And so that meditation is at dawsongift.com, D-A-W-S-O-N, gift.com. And then the third thing to do is download our free app. It's called Stress Solution. Download from the App Store. And that's where you can actually get an EFT session from a live in-person practitioner right through your smartphone anytime you want. So that's Stress Solution, and that app is well worth getting. So those are the three places: blissbrain.com, dawsongift.com, and the Stress Solution app.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Dawson, thank you so much for coming on the show. I not only appreciate you coming on the show, but thank you so much for everything you're doing for the world and for your fellow souls out there. And everyone listening, please go meditate. Go get his meditations. Meditate. We need more meditators in this world. If everyone meditated, the world would be such a different place, wouldn't it?
It would be. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you again, my friend.
It's been a joy. Thanks, Alex.
I want to thank Dawson so much for coming on the show and sharing his knowledge and journey with all of us. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to reach out to Dawson or buy any of his books or courses, head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com/068. And if you've only been listening to this over podcast and you want to watch these amazing conversations, please subscribe to our YouTube channel at nextlevelsoul.com/YouTube. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, trust the journey. It is here to teach you. I'll talk to you soon.